I'm Jim, alcoholic. I'm sober by the grace of God and all these people up here. When I came here, they were here. And I think that's the reason I've stayed here. You know, I could never repay AA for what it's done for me. I had tried AA in my mid-20s. But, you know, back then, that was probably 50 years ago, and they'd say, well, you know, he's too young anyway. He won't make it. And of course, you didn't tell them you'd like to do those other things, too, because they would run you off. But I can't believe the way your life changes if you let it. And 35 years ago today, I had been back in AA 2 days. 3 days ago, on the coldest, darkest night of my life, I was in Newark, Ohio, in a condemned hotel with no money, no place to go, and nobody wanted me. And the big book speaks, and when you see the doctor's opinion about a spiritual awakening and spiritual experiences and things like that, and I didn't think something like that could ever happen to me, but when I laid in that old condemned hotel and I worked those first four steps in reverse, and I took that searching and fearless moral inventory, and all I saw was 30 years of drunk, and I knew if it was going to change, God would have to do it. And I asked him, please, if he really exists, and I didn't think he did, you know, he'd have to remove the desire. And it's like he just got me up in his lap and put his arms around me and loved me, and he gave me that little bit of faith that if I didn't drink, things would be all right. That second step, I knew I'd always be crazy, but, you know, booze had brought me there. But, you know, you have times in your life where... and I stand up for one reason. The old-timer said you do that. You stand up. You talk real loud so everybody can hear you. You stand up real tall so everybody can hear you and see you. And you sit down real quick so they'll love you. But anyway, I come from a different generation than you all do. And the first vivid memory I ever had is when the Navy Department came to that little farm town I lived and knocked on Dad and Mom's door, and his whole family was there, and they told him his brother had been killed on the Arizona at Pearl Harbor. Now, that, you know, there's things like that, you know, all the crying and the mad and everything. So we left the farm. Dad went to California and took us out there, and he worked at Long Beach Naval Dry Docks all during the war. When the war ended, I can remember that last day, everybody was drunk. Even little kids got drunk that day. But, you know, they had open house then for the family and their employees, and I remember going around this big building, and here's a great, great big white hospital ship with a Red Cross in it, and one of them Japanese kamikaze planes had went into the stack, but it didn't explode. You know, I can remember those things. So we came back to Ohio. Dad started farming, and he had made enough money, he built a filling station and welding shop right next to the feed mill there. And all of us kids back then had to work. And when I turned 14, I got a driver's license, I found out where the bootlegger was, and I found out about girls, and I've been a wreck ever since. And that might sound funny, but it's just about the truth, because I like drinking. And to me, real good liquor don't come out of a bonded or a labeled bottle, it comes out of a quart mason jar. And that's the stuff I liked. And when I'd take the top off, I had to drink it, and it was all gone. I mean, you know, it'd fry my mind and sear my soul, but I loved it. But I managed to make it through high school. Dad told me that he'd always said he would sign for me to go in the military. I wanted to get away from that farm. I wanted to get away from that filling station. You know, because he'd have me up 5 o'clock in the morning. If I was out all night drunk as a kid, I was still milking them cows at 5 o'clock in the morning and working that filling station. Well, when I turned 17, he wouldn't sign. And I know the reason he didn't sign, because his brother had been killed on the Arizona. So I joined the National Guard, and we went to Alpena for summer camp when I was 17. And I picked up a lady on the street, and that's the first time I ever had a gun put to my head, and I heard click, click, and I'm going to blow your brains out. You know, I'm just a kid. But it didn't happen, and, you know, I was always in trouble like that, but nothing. I don't know the times I've been in jail, but, you know, and I've been beat a lot of times, even left for dead, but I always accepted those things that booze would do that to me. So I volunteered for the draft because Dad wouldn't sign, and I went in February of 1955, went to Fort Knox, and you're pretty well locked up during basic training and tank training and stuff like that. And then they were there recruiting for 82nd Airborne Division. I had my break between basic and there, and I went down and I went through 82nd Airborne Division School, 1955. And when I went home and got my car, I came back, and we were actually not even allowed in Fayetteville with bars, but I didn't pay attention to that. I pulled up in front of a bar, and I saw a lady there, and Her and I got, she worked in the bar, her and I got drunk that afternoon, and I moved in with her the next night. And that was pretty much my whole lifestyle. I had a natural gift to shoot and pull. I liked the girls that worked in the bars. And she could actually drink probably sometimes more than I could. And even though I was a good pool shooter, you know, it was a natural gift to stay drunk. Those little bumper pool tables, if I missed that first shot, she could beat me. It used to make me mad sometimes. She'd outdrink me and outshoot me in pool. But you know, that's the way life goes. But because she was always calling out there, and them other girls that I knew, they always had me on KP. And they would put me on pots and pans because I was the only one that washed the pots and pans clean. And old Pop Olivebaugh was a drunk. And the girl I lived with, her cousin, he owned the pool room. He was also the bootlegger. So we always kept a quart jar of that old good bootleg whiskey in that flour bin. Well, as it went on, we had a bunch of cooks got out. And old Pop Olivebaugh was the head cook. He said, I want horn in here. So I began cooking. And that's really a good duty for a drunk because, you know, you could go back there and take a little drink and keep on working. But to get rid of me, they actually sent me in 1956, 3rd Army Headquarters, Fort McPherson, in Atlanta, Georgia, to do honor guard prison chaser. And here I am, 20 years old, and we got the uniforms on. They wouldn't let us take civilian clothes. And them little Georgia peaches is everywhere about drove me nuts. So you can stick your thumb out and them girls pick you up. But I ran into a guy there, me and another boy that went down with me, and he said, you can go down the street here and you can sell blood for $5 a pint. And he said, there's a gay bar down here and you go down and drink for nothing. And you know, that was kind of unique to me. I had never been around things like that. But anyway, I found out selling that blood, I could get $5 a pint. And I sold 2 pints in 1 week, and I never will forget that second jug of liquor I had, that second pint. That movie Trapeze was on, and it was hot there in the middle of Atlanta in August. And these girls went to the movie, and I was going to follow them in and get picked up. And anyway, we got in there, and I took a big suck out of that whiskey and puked all over them. And that was the biggest riot. They had cops and stuff from everywhere. Well, I never seen that many cops. They even shut the movie clerk down to get rid of me. But, you know, it was in uniform, so what are they going to do with it? I actually tried to sell a third pint of blood that week, but they caught me. But you could go to those gay bars, and, you know, you drink for nothing. But, you know, for me, when I took the lid off, I drank till it was empty. I got out of the Army the week I turned 21. The next week, I had my first drunk driving charge, Columbus, Ohio. And I spent 3 days in the old Columbus City Jail. And that started a period of my life where, I don't know, it was just like I was crazy. I'd stick my thumb out, and I thumbed all over the United States, Route 66 from one end to the other, walked it, and I hit Interstate 10. And I ended up in Santa Monica. They had just taken my driver's license. And this is in 1957. I went to Douglas Aircraft. I got a job at Douglas Aircraft. Of course, I got a California driver's license, but there was no computers back then. They had taken my Ohio license, and I just got out of the military, so they didn't even check. But I got top security clearance and everything. And I was hired in as a riveter, but they lost me in the solder room. And my dad being a welder, I was pretty familiar with welding, and I was soldering firing cables for the old Thor Able booster, if you know what that was, before NASA. Well, 6 weeks later, they found me and they were going to take me to the riveting school. And that lady says, no, you're going to put him out on the line. He's going to do firing cables. So here I had top security clearance for everything. I had a good job, $85 a week in 1957, a lot of money. Every weekend in Tijuana was even better. I was crazy. I just loved drinking, and I didn't care what happened to me. And I managed to make a year before they fired me. And really, all I could do was get jobs like out of manpower or work programs. Or I finally joined the labor union in Newark, Ohio, which was out of Columbus. But Dan remembers, he wanted me to tell, I was in the bar just after, in Delaware, Ohio, just after I got out. And I got in a fight, and I'm beating the guy about half to death, and I realized something was hitting me, and it wasn't that guy. And I jumped up, and the bartender had a blackjack about that long, and I started right, when I got up, the blood was clearing my shoes. And I went back, I went home, we got two of my buddies, and we came back, and I remember, I come back in, there was cops everywhere, and that cop said, you got the hardest hit I ever hit, and I went after him again, you know, trying to hit him, and the cops were laughing, they didn't let me do it. But, you know, that Delaware County Jail, I honestly don't know how many times I've been in jail there. I even had another, by the time I hit my, I guess I must have been 22 or 23, I got my second drunk driving charge. And I don't know if you've ever been around Delaware, Ohio, but on Route 23 south of town, there's a state patrol chasing there. and I'd passed out in the driveway of the State Patrol Station, and these cops come and drag me in there, and they say, blow in this machine. And I go, they said, man, look at that reading. He should be dead. And I'm sitting there, well, I've been a lot drunker than this, you know. It's goofy, you know. And then I got another drunk driving charge. It was too close together around Delaware there, and they gave me an automatic 10 days. But I just couldn't stand the thought of not drinking. I always accepted whatever would happen. But one time a friend of mine knew I was going to get drunk, and I paddled a boat out in the middle of a little pond, and it was all foggy the next morning, and I go, Jim, hey Jim, where you at? And I'd got a jug of that good liquor, you know. He said, man, you're wasted. He said, come on, we'll go up to the house, and I'll drive your car, and you can lay it out at Mom's. Well, it was real foggy, and the next thing I knew, here the blue lights is on, and they take us to jail before daylight. And this is in Delaware. So when they took us, they kept us all night, and the next day we go to court, we're in handcuffs, and Harold knew he was going to do 45 days for driving without a license, and I didn't know what they was going to do to me, but they fined me $33 in cost, or $25 in cost was $33. So when we're going down to pay the fine, that cop said, why have I got you guys in handcuffs? I said, you know, just old minor offense, it's traffic offense. He said, and that lady was taking them away. I said, whatever they done, they shouldn't have got caught. And I said, what'd you say? And she said, whatever you done, you shouldn't have got caught. And I said, take me with him, put me in jail. I'm sick and drunk, I don't want to go back. Just put me in jail. And there again, I had every cop in the place come. They was all going to kill me because I wasn't going to pay the fine. But they put me back in jail. And you could holler over the bitch box. You know, I used to lay it out there at $3 a day, but it was up to $10 a day then. And I hollered over the bitch box, how much to get Horn out of jail? And they said, $33. And I said, well, I'll stay for dinner. So after dinner, I asked them again, how much to get me out? And they said, $33. And I said, well, I guess I'll stay for supper. So after supper, I asked them, how much to get Horn out of jail? And they said, $33. And I said, I guess I'll stay all night again. But, you know, I didn't care. You know, if it kept me from drinking, my whole life had been either wanting to get drunk or wanting to get off of drunk. So by the time I was 25, I'd already had, I know, three drunk driving charges. And I found AA. I had met a lady in the bar who wasn't supposed to be able to get pregnant, and she did. And I think that was the only reason. And back then, that's been 50 years ago, there weren't that many AA meetings. And there was one in Gahanna, Ohio. Do you know where Gahanna was? Either one? Well, anyway, there was one there, and I walked around and around and around that church, and a guy saw me, and he came out and got me. And he brought me in, and of all things, there was a guy there I knew from Johnstown, Ohio, and he, well, I knew him. I actually, you see, I was drinking in the bar at 14 because everybody knew everybody, and it wasn't that long after World War II, and everybody had been military and wounded and legs shot off and, you know, things like that. So I knew this man, and I started going to AA meetings. In fact, one of the AA meetings was the Columbus City Jail. We used to go down there. But I'm one of the original founding members of the Johnstown, Ohio group of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was Dwayne and Carl and Lawrence and I. And I stayed for a year, but you know, it was tough back then. You didn't tell them, you guys, you did drugs and done other things like that, because they didn't want to hear it. This is an alcoholic program. But you know, a drug is a drug is a drug, they say. But I stayed for a year, I didn't drink, and when I celebrated my 1 year anniversary, I got a plaque with the Serenity Prayer, a big book, and my medallions. And I got drunk. I stayed drunk 15 more years. And I finally, in 71, I couldn't take Ohio anymore. I was in jail or just ahead of jail all the time. I just couldn't take it. So I came to Florida. That's been 41 years ago. I came here drunk, never got enough money to leave, but I think Florida has saved my life, you know. I left here in 77 and went to Houston to work, and my Florida license was expiring, and I go in and ask there in Houston how to get my license, and the lady go out and says, go out and get in your vehicle, and there'll be somebody waiting. I went out there, and there's a cop sitting there, and I got a can of beer on the dash and an open liquor bottle on the seat. And he didn't put me in jail. He gave me a driver's license. I can't believe that. Today, you know where you're going. But back then, it seemed like you could get away with that stuff. They looked at things different. But Houston, Texas was, to me, the drunk that ended all drunks. And I was finishing cement. I'd start before daylight and work till after dark, but every corner there was a corner of dope to smoke or liquor to drink or, you know, something. And I had an old car that was so ugly and bad that there was always a warrant out on it because it wouldn't pass the safety inspection. And I was probably in jail in Houston at least 10 times for that doggone old car, but they never got me for drunk driving or drugs. You know, that's amazing to me. I can't believe, even after I left AA in my mid-20s, I've never had another drunk driving charge. I don't know why. I guess I was supernaturally protected. But when I got out of Houston, I went back to Ohio where the mama of my kids was, and the same old stuff, and she'd call the cops on me, and I hadn't done nothing, and they'd put me in jail, and I hadn't done nothing, and they'd let me go, and finally is when I ended up in that old condemned hotel. And I knew that was the end of the road for me. I had had that year in AA, and I pretty well knew what the steps were. I hated the big book because, like I said, in the doctor's opinion, unless there was a psychic change, there was little hope of recovery. Unless there was a spiritual awakening or experience, there was little hope of recovery. 84 and 85, what the promises was, I wouldn't even read it. You get into the stories, everybody had always had a time when there was something before alcohol. I never had anything before alcohol. I got drunk when I was a kid and stayed drunk. I probably had 300 jobs in my life. But anyway, when I was in that old condemned hotel, I got out. This would have been my second day out of that old hotel, and I was froze to death. And they had taken me to an AA club in Newark, Ohio. And by that time, every place that there was a hole in me, I was bleeding. I could touch me or scratch me, and I'd bleed. And a guy got out of a treatment center called Mary Haven in Columbus, Ohio. He said, "Man, unless we get you some help, you're going to die." So they put me in the treatment center, 28-day program. And the only thing I can remember about that, because I was so sick, it asked how you would forgive on a blackboard, and you had to write all this down. And I could look at that, and by the time I got ready to write it down, "You forgive by acceptance," I couldn't write it down because, you know, I was so wasted on drugs and alcohol. But they let me, when I got out of there, they put me in a halfway house, which I was glad of. But I've always been real hyper, and I guess more crazy than anything else. I always got to be doing something, working. And I couldn't stand the thoughts of being on welfare in that halfway house, or food stamps, or whatever. So I got a job in a place like a Kmart called Hex Cleaning Floors, and I always tried. But when they kicked me out of the halfway house, there was two other ladies in there with me, and they kicked them out too. And the one lady I was going with, trying to get next to her girlfriend, and I did something that I had never, ever done in my life. I had them two women with me. I'm drunk, crazy. I went to my dad and mom's. My dad and mom never drank. They'd always come and get me out of jail. They might see me after I'd been drunk for a month. I remember one time, Point Pleasant, West Virginia. I had evidently got put in jail there, but when I came to myself, I was in L.A., and I called home to mom and dad, and I said, "You know, can you send me some money so I can come home?" And mom said, "Well, when they let you out of jail in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, they never gave you your billfold back, so they mailed it to us." That's the only reason I knew I was in there. I'd get drunk sometimes and wake up under a palm tree and didn't know if I was in Florida or California. Just, you know, I didn't care. And you know, the times I've been beat and left for dead and the blood I've sold and 15 cent a night flop houses, it didn't make any difference. But when I asked God for help this time, 3 days ago, that was the most sincere statement I had ever made. Please. Well, anyway, when I went there with these two women at home, my dad, he took these ladies up the farm and took them up to the pond. And I only got as far as the grape arbor down there, and here come my mom. And my mom never, ever came down there. And I could see the hurt in her and the mad in her, and she could have killed me. And she says, "You know, Jim, we should have had you committed a long time ago when you was a boy. But we don't care anymore. If you just go away back to Florida, where we don't know where you're at, your dad and I might live a little longer." And she says, she said, "Even if I gave you money, you'd be broke before you got to the road. We could send you to town to get something and not see you for 2 or 3 months." And it was the truth. And that really hurt me. But mom had also said, before this happened, she said, "If you can remember the places you'd worked in Houston, Texas, you tell me and I'll send off and see if I can get your income tax back." Well, it wasn't long after that. And that was, all the times, Mike, I say, my folks have never seen me drinking over 5 times, and that was one of them. But anyway, here's an $1,800 income tax check. And my brother, farm across the road, had an old Plymouth in his barn and had cow shit clear up to the windows and everything. And I gave him $25 for it, and I headed for Florida. And I think Florida is the reason that I'm sober today. Because I had bought a property over here on 71, or in 71, it was cheap back then. And I had a travel trailer on. Well, I hadn't been back but 2 or 3 days, and the mother of my kid showed up with my daughter, and here's my daughter, 18 years old, opening beer. and offering them to me. And my stomach actually turned over. I thought, you know, they'd rather see me dead and get sober. And I never called the cops on nobody because they've always called them on me. But I called the cops on them. They told her to leave. I went to an AA meeting in Dunellen and found out there was one down here. I went to the Dunellen meeting on a Sunday night, and I drank it. You know, I spent a year and a half in AA doing 7 to 10 meetings a week, you know, because I had made my mind to do that. The first time, the year I had, I didn't do anything. I just sat and went. But I knew that I would have to do all these meetings. So that year and a half before I, or year, it was over a year before I got back to Florida, I kept drinking, and I would go to meetings drunk. But I got back here, and I come in here on a Tuesday night, that little building next door, and John Fishcamp and these guys, I've never had another drink since, by the grace of God. But I was so crazy, you know, there's a lot of people know me but Dynamite. And old Brad was an old-timer when he came here, and he used to say, eternal vigilance is a small price to pay for sobriety. But he called me Dynamite because he said that I was like a stick of dynamite, hyper. I shook so bad he's afraid I was going to explode. That's what he's talking about. I don't know, but you know, I could never ever repay AA for what it's done. You know, I hadn't been off the booze very long. Then a lady I knew, she came and wanted me to do a concrete job, and I was so sick I couldn't really go. I signed up for Social Security disability, but the mom of my kids had done that. And I was going to Ocala with a guy to see how much money we would get, and he said, man, I'm going to get enough money to buy a new car. He said, how much are you getting? And I said, I don't want that. I want to go to work. And that's when I went met Terry. I got a job, a friend of mine. In fact, he used to clean here years ago. His wife worked at the Yankee Town School cleaning the floors. And I met Terry there when I was doing that. And I didn't last very long. I was too sick. But, you know, God moves in strange ways, his wonders to perform. And it seems, when I met this lady that asked me to do the concrete work, I was sick, bad. But you know, I was done with, I didn't want anything to do with women. When I asked God for help, the cigarettes and the street drugs and the VA drugs and the booze went, all at one time. And I can't, you know, it's hard to put together the way things happened that first 2 or 3 years, but finally, that lady and I have been married over 30 years now. And between, you know, AA saved my flesh, but her and her daddy got me into the Bible, and I say they saved my soul. You know, I can't believe that people can actually have a spiritual wife instead of a fleshly wife. But I just can't, you know, all these people here, Buttermilk Builder, when I first came around, he was like me. He would come to meetings drunk. And I was kidding him one night over in the canoe. I said, well, bring him over to that old trailer and I'll dump booze in him. And the next thing they showed up with him. Of course, the old timers, they jumped all over me, but I did. I dumped vodka in him for 3 months. And an old timer came down for the winter and he said, you got to start putting sugar in that now to get him off of that. So we started putting sugar in that vodka. He was sober 18 years, worked for the county. When he retired, he found out he had prostate cancer and he started drinking. And I never will forget, poor thing. I was the only one he'd let see him, and here he's sitting in this wheelchair, and the house is all full of holes for the things he was shooting at. But he said, you know, Jim, I should have never quit work. And I thought about that. You know, I don't dare me ever have time on my hands. But the only job that I've ever had came right out of this room right here. She was a substance abuse counselor at Hernando County Mental Health. And I went down there, took a $3 an hour job, driving crazy people to and from a day treatment program. And I loved that job. I mean, I fit right in. I was as crazy as they were, but I wasn't taking debts. But you know, listen, you don't know the people they had down there that had master's degrees. And they had a history of drugs and alcohol. But they had diagnosed them as schizophrenic or manic depressive or bipolar, and they'd shoot them full of Prolixin and Haldol and turn zombies, they told them. But we had one boy, he said, you know, Jim, he said, you're crazier than I am. And he said, I got papers to prove I'm crazy. But you know, what I found was really unique, we would always go somewhere on an outing on Fridays. And I transported them to, you know, the day treatment program consisted of making sure they were taking their meds and halfway eating and staying clean, and they would see the doctor. Well, whenever we would go anywhere, I knew exactly where every one of them were. Because, you know, living on the streets like I had, you know, it's either fight or flight, and you've got to know where you're at all times. But we went to SeaWorld one time, and we had two that had been, one had been in the Navy and another one was a master's degree in art, and they would always get lost. Well, I'm with all these master's degree people, staff, and the head of security come right straight to me. He says, I know you're watching him. He said, those other two, we've got him, you know. But, you know, I thought that was so funny that I worked with people. There was one guy down here that he had a master's degree in substance abuse. He was gay, and he came in here every day drunk, and I threatened to kick his ass lots of times. He was scared to death of me. You know, that's a bad example to do to someone. You know, when you come off the streets, you don't want to smell booze on a guy that's talking to you about not drinking. I mean, I thought that was bad. But anyway, after 10 years, the finances got bad from the government, and we all lost our job. But I, up to that time, I was probably 50 years old before I had ever had a year on the same job. Then my pastor took me down here to Citrus County Schools to drive a school bus. And I said, I ain't driving no school bus. And he said, yeah, you are. And I said, I ain't driving no. And you know, believe it or not, when they did the background check for my school records, none of these drunk driving charges or these other things, I never was bad. I never was a felon. And I wasn't a good liar or thief. But none of those drunk driving charges ever came up. And to this day, I'm amazed. I don't know why. So I drove a school bus for 15 years, and I just retired last March. My wife got sick. And that was because of Bill. When he said, you know, I should have never quit work, I thought, oh, no, I hadn't better. But I've had cervical spine fusion operations twice on my neck. And this last time, I can't hardly get over it. But, you know, 77 years old, and if I thought a guy was going to hurt a drunk, I'd kick his ass yet. I just don't like people that hurt a drunk or somebody laying around. You know, when I lived on the street, there's three kinds of people there. There's those old road bums that like it there, and they just travel all over the United States. Then there's people like me that go on one of them old headbusters and lay drunk for a month, and then you walk off. And then there's the mentally ill people there that can't leave. It's awful, you know. But one of the old-timers from my old original home group had asked me one time when I went to the meeting drunk, what the hell kind of drinking pattern have you gotten? I didn't know what he's talking about. You know, it scared me to death. But today, I know my drinking pattern. From the time I was a boy, I could go maybe 3 months or 6 months or 9 months, and I'd go lay drunk for a month. Just literally wherever I ended up, I'd go. That's why I never made a whole year and why I never had a year on the same job. I just, you know, shovel and just old nasty work. I had to do it. But the 10 years at mental health, and then I spent 15 years at the school board, and I even get a retirement. Of course, I call that an alimony check. We couldn't get along no more. We got divorced, you know. But, you know, Citrus County has been good to me. Everybody in this room has been good to me. I can't believe that, you know, an old sorry ass like me can come off the street. And I never had any education. I didn't know anything. I didn't know a thing when I came in here. I actually felt it was 5 years before God finally removed that total desire. You know, and every day, please, God, and I do that serenity prayer. Please, you've got to remove the desire. But once I realized that desire had been removed, I felt like I was just like a dry sponge, and everything these people said I would take. I just soaked it right up. And, you know, I had been sober probably, or off the booze probably 6 months, and they gave me the keys to the Dunellen meeting, and I made coffee in Dunellen probably 5 years. And I really, that's where I began to open up. You know, I said I'd never done nothing when I was a kid, but I would get there early, and back then you'd have to open the tables up and get the chairs out, and you'd get all the literature out and make the coffee. So I would sit on the countertop there, and if somebody came in the car and they didn't even come in the meeting, I'd go out and say, hey man, this isn't the right place, the coffee's already made. You know, and I had to make sure that I knew everybody's name, and I had to greet everybody, because I had never done that before. I didn't want to do it, but you finally, my sponsor, when I first came in that little building next door, he was there, because I had went to him one time, knew he was an AA, about a friend of mine that was on a drunk periodic. Well, when I came in, of course, he jumped all over me and told me what he thought about my AA, what I knew about AA, and I was going to do what he told me, and I was glad. But Neil, this friend I'm talking about, was a periodic. He was on antabuse from the VA, and he called up one time and said, Jim, I'm going off the antabuse, so I knew he was going to get drunk. So John Cutright and I, or John C., and I started watching him, and we went over there one morning, and he's all sick and crazy and laughing, and he worked down here at the high school as a custodian. And he said, oh, Jim, I'm so happy. He says, I can't believe it. I am so happy. And I said, well, Neil, what's wrong? He said, I've won Support Person of the Year, and I've won $10,000 and various other prizes. And I thought, well, Neil, how do you know that? I said, you know, I knew he hadn't even been out of that chair. He said, oh, he said, you know, the phone don't work. It came right over that fan. And, of course, John about freaked out. But they ended up, they put him over there in detox, and one of our friends here, his wife was working a detox, and I called over there, and I don't know how many times my sponsor and I take people to detox, but she wouldn't even tell me his internet. That really irked me, because, you know, I'd been watching him. And but anyway, I went over one night, he'd called for that old bottle of Mad Dog, that old MD-2020 Mogan David, and I watched him take that drink, and he put the top on it, and he said, "Jim, pray for me," and the next day he was dead. And that just tore me all to pieces. I couldn't believe it. But if it hadn't been for these guys right here, they said, "Well, you know, it wasn't the drink that you took him that killed him. It was that one that he had taken like 3 weeks before. It was the one that killed him." So you see, that makes sense. And it isn't how much we drink. It's what it does to us. We had a lady named Donella Mary over there. Her and her husband were professional people in Washington, D.C. And they never had kids because they made so much money in being professional. But she said she used to cook with wine. And after she cooked, she'd just drink the rest of the bottle. She said one night her husband called her a drunken bitch, and she said, "I was devastated. I'd never, ever heard anybody say anything like that to me." But she said, "I got to thinking." She says, "I was a drunken bitch on one bottle of wine," and she'd been sober for 15 years. Now, that was the kind of stories I like to hear, you know. I really enjoyed those kind of stories. It ain't what you drink. And I think fear and pain's the greatest motivators in the world. You know, when you've had enough, you've had enough. But like I say, I'm sober by the grace of God, and all these people here, a lot of them don't make it. And you know, the holidays are coming up, we're going to lose more. I had a couple trailers over there on that property I'd bought. I used to keep drunks in all the time. You never know if they get sober, but you know, you can plant seeds, and that's all you can do. Well, anyway, I thank you for letting me run off at the mouth, and I kind of use this as the fifth step I haven't done in a long time. Thank you.